The partisan divide in the United States has widened to a chasm. Legislators vote along party lines and rarely cross the aisle. Political polarization is personal, too, and it's making us, well, miserable. Surveys show that Americans have become more fearful and hateful of supporters of the opposing political party, and imagine that they hold much more extreme views than they actually do. In the new book, The Way Out, How to Overcome Toxic Polarization, Peter Coleman offers an escape from this morass. The social psychologist from Columbia University explores how conflict resolution and complexity science provide guidance for dealing with seemingly intractable political differences. Again, the name of the book is The Way Out, How to Overcome Toxic Polarization, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Peter Coleman to the roundtable this morning. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You are a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University. What brought you to this subject and wanting to talk about it in such detail?
So I have, with a team of people, studied long-term, what we call intractable conflicts, just conflicts that get stuck for sometimes decades. And this current trap of what we call toxic polarization fits in that category. It's has a 50 plus year pattern of increasingly intense political polarization on all kinds of measures. And so we've begun to apply our thinking and our research specifically to this directly about 4 years ago. We sort of pivoted to focus specifically on political polarization.
So when you talk about that 50 plus years, is there an actual turning point?
Well, we see, again, it depends on what you're measuring, but we see in uptakes in things like affective polarization, which is the degree to which Republicans feel a sense of disdain for Democrats and vice versa. And that has been growing since the 1970s, since the mid to late 1970s. Also, if you look at voting patterns on legislation in Washington, D.C., in Congress, you see less and less bipartisanship, more and more obstructionist activity against the others. And that, too, has been increasing since the late 70s. So it does seem somewhere in the 1970s we took this turn on this path and are still on it today.
So it's too easy to say, and certainly painting with too broad a brush, to blame it on Watergate.
Well, I do think what happened, what we see in societies that get really stuck into very divided patterns is that there are oftentimes kind of major shocks, political shocks that take place that precede them by several years, and then eventually they get stuck in these patterns. So if you think back into the mid to late 60s and early 70s, there was a variety of things. We had several political assassinations, and we had the passing of Roe v. Wade, and we had a cultural revolution and a very unpopular war, and Watergate. There was a series of events that destabilized American culture and really had people start to question and strategize about the future of the country. And that's about, in the wake of that, you start to see this degree of divisiveness. So I think Watergate definitely was a factor, and the distrust in government and other institutions like media, which began around that era. But it's not the only factor. It's one of many.
So let's look at the word toxic. I mean, where we are now, you can't think of it being more toxic. And yet, of course, that isn't true in our history, right? I mean, we have seen this before, although it does seem that it's especially nasty now.
Yeah, it's a different. So, just to be clear, polarization is not a bad thing. It's in a two-party political system like ours. It's a necessary thing. It serves as a check and balance so that neither side goes too extreme. And so we need some degree of polarization in our politics. But this degree of polarization, the enmity, the vilification of the other, and then even the spikes in hate crimes and violence that we're seeing, is at a very high level. We haven't seen this kind of enmity since, the U.S. Civil War. So it's highly concerning, and people should be, should be worried about it and should be actively thinking about the way out.
So I want to talk with you about some of the ways out. But before we do that, you are a social psychologist, and in this book, you very much look at conflict resolution and the science that can provide us guidance in dealing with these political differences. And I want to get into that with you. But we all have to be willing participants, don't we? I mean, it seems that, like people who are trying to change very deep-grained aspects of their own personality, have to admit that there is a problem, right? So don't we all have to do that for this to work?
Yeah, to some degree, that's true. I see this as akin to an addiction, because right. It is what we call a biopsychosocial structural problem. This is something that's, you know, within us. It's on our impulses. It's in our psychology. It's in our relationships or lack of relationships with people on the other side. It's in, you know, other kinds of structures like the media that we consume. So it is a big problem like an addiction. And oftentimes it does require people to kind of bottom out. The good news there is that by some polls that have come out over the last couple of years, the vast majority of middle Americans, the more moderate Americans, not the extreme wings, but the vast majority of the middle are exhausted and fed up and really just feel like our country, particularly since January 6th, has hit bottom. We're ready for a reset. What we need now is a clear sense of what to do. Like, what does the alternative look like so that we can, you know, pivot and move out of this trap?
So who is the we, in the sense of who leads the charge here? Is this on us? Is this on our leaders? Is it all of the above? Who leads us through this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, to some degree, so it is all of the above. It is, because it's such a complex set of problems that are kind of feeding each other in strange ways and causing these pressures that split us apart. It's not something that we can just independently decide to do. It definitely needs to be part of a what I would call a broader social movement of people that have energy to do something else. I mean, the good news is that there is work happening, for example, in Congress today. There's a group called the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress, and their mandate is to figure out how to fix and depolarize Congress. There's also something called the Problem Solving Caucus within Congress, similar kind of mandate. So there is work in different sectors, for example, in journalism. There's a group called Solutions Journalism, and they look at how do journalists and reporting contribute to our polarization? How do we mitigate that? Social media plays a role. So there are definitely things that we can do in our communities, but there are other things that need to happen as well. And unfortunately, you know, for example, the Biden administration can't do a lot about this because they're sitting in the epicenter of the divisiveness, right? Anything they do, well-intentioned or not, is going to be weaponized by half the country. So they're pretty constrained in what they can do. They cannot make things worse through vitriolic, you know, rhetoric and vilification of the other. But there's not a lot they can do immediately in addressing these tensions. It has to come a bit more bottom up and through these various institutional sectors that I mentioned.
I mean, one of the things that I worry about, and I was thinking about as I was reading this book, is that, you know, you mentioned January 6th, and we think, oh my God, yeah, you know, this, it can't get worse than this. And then it seems to, like we said that before, yeah, January 6th, whether it's Charlottesville, yeah, or somewhere else, like, oh, we can't get any worse, yeah, than this. So we're not necessarily at the bottom yet.
No, not necessarily. You're right. And things can get worse, are likely to get worse. We're likely to see more incidents. You know, I mean, hate groups have grown by 55% over the past 4 years, and hate crimes have risen in many you know, areas of the country. And political violence is on the upswing. So there's likely to be more and more of this, particularly because you still have, you know, the majority of half the country that believe that the election was stolen, it was fraudulent. You know, there is that kind of message out there that people adhere to, and it, you know, starts to, continues to feed their rage. So we haven't seen the last of this. But again, the good news is there is enough of America, the middle America, the middle, you know, what this group more in common calls the middle tribes, who are fed up and don't, you know, become disengaged with this kind of, you know, vitriol and insanity and want to do something else. And that's the group of Americans that I've written this book for, to try to be specific about what they can do if they are ready to pivot. Here's how to do that.
Without muddying the waters too much, one of the other things that fascinates me about this subject is that we can certainly look at our history. We can look at the what we have gone through, and we talked about Watergate and before the generation before that, and all of the cataclysmic events that brought us to that point. But we see this globally. We see democratic governments throughout this world that are having very similar problems and are seeing polarization that they have never seen before.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there definitely are, you know, global forces that contribute to, you know, this kind of populism and this rise and, you know, need for strong, more authoritarian leadership. And it is, you know, migration trends or demographic changes. It's changes in the economy, you know, more joblessness, anxiety about those things. And then, you know, put on top of that pandemics, and you have people who are very anxious. And when we're anxious, we do tend to look for people to blame. We tend to look for towards outgroups to blame. And currently in this country, that's particularly organized around the political other. You know, the red or the blue other.
Peter Coleman is our guest. The name of the new book, The Way Out, How to Overcome Toxic Polarization. So when it comes to overcoming it, you have a chapter in the book called Reset, Capture the Power of New Beginnings. And in writing that, you talk about the starting line. So let's focus on that, of setting that reset and what the starting line, where that starting line is and what it should be.
Well, sort of, you know, just to go back to the metaphor of addiction, part of what happens with addicts when they hit bottom or are confronted by their family and really feel like they just have to do something else, it does require that they stop and they, you know, basically go into recovery, which could mean in politics that we, you know, wean ourselves off of the more hostile news programs, the more addictive news programs that we sort of are more inclined to, you know, watch and obsess over today. But part of it is, you know, finding other people that are also fed up and that are also trying to make an adjustment. And the good news on that is that there's a group called the Bridging Divides Initiative. It's a website that you can go to. It's out of Princeton University. And what this group has done is they've mapped, there's a map of the U.S., and if you go to an interactive map, you can find your community. And you can identify the what they call bridge building groups and organizations that are currently working in your community. And they do different kinds of things. Sometimes they're simply dialogue groups, but sometimes they move into groups that, you know, take on issues that they all are concerned about across the divide, like, you know, poverty in a neighborhood or elderly housing. Or so there are these activities that people can get into in communities that are also trying to, you know, find a better way forward. And that's really important because, as I said, this is hard to do alone. Even if we individually are fed up, it's helpful to find others who are also, you know, trying to move in the same direction.
Part of this, of course, is talking, right? Is conversations, is understanding.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a critical component of it. Part of what I believe it's, well, first of all, how we talk to one another matters, because most of us think that in, you know, reaching out to somebody on the other side and launching into a debate, you know, if I can just sit down with one of them and explain to them why they're wrong and why I'm right and why their leader's
right.
Insane, you know. And so we automatically move into this more competitive form of debate around politics. It's sort of hardwired in American culture to do that. And that oftentimes just escalates. And most people, you know, Pew Research tells us that most people leave those conversations feeling more frustrated and more alienated. So under these kinds of conditions, simply sitting down and talking isn't enough. But again, it depends on how you talk. What these kind of bridge building groups will do is they encourage something that we call dialogue. And dialogue is the opposite of debate. It's a place where people kind of share their own personal stories, where they came from, who they are, what's important to them. And they don't really even move into politics until there is a sense of, you know, the kind of reality and context of the people in the room. And then they start to talk about the issues. So there's a certain process that helps open people up to learning. And if you can move people into that space, then these conversations often go much better. They learn about one another. They learn about themselves and things about themselves that they weren't aware of.
You write in the book, in a chapter called Complicate, Embrace Contradictory Complexity, about just that, about complexity. And you look at it at integrative complexity, political complexity, emotional complexity, behavioral complexity, structural complexity, group complexity and contradiction, social identity complexity. And these are all fascinating and all layers of that contradiction and, yes, of complexity. My very basic question to you, psychologist person, is we're not really hardwired to do complexity well, are we?
Well, definitely when we're under threat or feel that we're under threat, we feel particularly anxious. When we're in negative states, we do look to simplify. We want to know, are you on my side or are you on the other side, right? So we definitely, there is a tendency under certain conditions for humans to drop into that. But again, it sort of depends on how we live our life. If we live our life in a community where you have, you know, Republicans and Democrats who go to church together and they work together and they play, you know, on a soccer team together or whatever, and you have those kinds of relationships, then it's, you know, much more difficult to oversimplify them. Even if their leader or members of their party start to say things that irritate you, it's hard for you to sort of say, oh, they're all alike, and, you know, really move into the simplistic us versus them dynamic. So if we're living a life that is more what I would say complicated, in other words, you're listening to people who have different political views than you, but are smart and you think are, you know, well-intentioned, even though you differ with them on some issues, you know, intentionally seek them out. If you do that, if you travel to places with folks that are different from you, if you have in your community, your family, your community, people who you can disagree with, but not in a disagreeable way, those kinds of experiences really buffer you from oversimplifying the other.
You write in the book, decades of research on cognitive dissonance has shown that most Americans really hate to contradict themselves. We absolutely despise being seen as acting in a way that is inconsistent with our more important values, being called a hypocrite, or having to change our public stance on a moral or political issue, a flip-flopper. Doing so brings a sense of confusion that triggers feelings of noxious anxiety. That idea of a sense of confusion, I mean, that's part of it, too, that you have to figure it out in your own mind of what you're trying to communicate.
Yeah. And then, you know, on many of the issues that are dividing us today, you know, take immigration, take, you know, Obamacare, healthcare, you know, any of these issues, they're highly complicated issues. And part of what happens under the current, you know, conditions of hate and enmity is we simplify them and we make immigration about a wall, whether there should be a wall or not be a wall. Well, you know, that's a very minor component in the immigration dilemmas that we face in this country, you know. So we have to sometimes work hard, because emotionally we're drawn to simplify. We have to work hard to, you know, challenge ourselves and our families and those in our communities to consider other perspectives, other aspects of these problems, and to, you know, make them more nuanced, because the world is a complicated place and these issues are highly nuanced. And there are no simple solutions to these. And anybody that's selling you that is not telling you the whole story.
The name of Peter Coleman's book is The Way Out. So this may seem to be, I don't know, a silly question, but to me it's not bad. But we'll let you judge. Which is, when we're out, will we necessarily know that we have gotten out? We have to keep doing what we're doing here, or we can go back in, right?
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, again, so one of the projects that I run at Columbia is the study of sustainably peaceful societies. These are societies like Costa Rica, Mauritius in Africa, the Scandinavian countries. And these are places that have kind of intentionally decided that they're kind of done with war. They don't want civil war. They don't want, you know, war with neighbors. They really just are preferring a different approach to, you know, intergroup relations and political relations. And even these places, even when they hit stressors, they figure out ways to increase tolerance and acceptance and move forward. So, but it's not something that necessarily happens automatically. It can be more normative, right? There can be strong taboos about being violent against certain groups, and there can be norms about trying to talk things and work things out, and that's helpful. But there is an intentionality to it. They know that in order to keep the peace, you have to learn to tolerate differences. You have to learn to respectfully disagree, you know, enough with others, and not just jump into the kinds of hostility that we so readily do, particularly on social media today.
Do you feel, after having written this book and laying this out, that we are at least, I mean, you talked about this administration, but do you think we're on a path? You mentioned the middle, but are we on a path to look for the way out?
Well, I hope so. And that's why I wrote the book. I think that's certainly possible. I think that this is in some ways a rare opportunity in time because we're coming out of COVID, because the economy is starting to come back, because, you know, an awareness of racial justice and the need injustice and the need for racial justice is up there, because all of these major factors have in some ways shut many of us down for a year and a half. And we're coming back to, you know, what could be a new life. This is a rare opportunity to shift. We won't know for a while whether or not enough of us take advantage of it. But part of what has to happen is that, you know, when there's such polarization, the story around our country and our culture is controlled by the extremes. On Twitter, 80% of the content on Twitter is put out by 10% of the participants. And what that means is that many of us become kind of passive consumers of this, in some ways, nonsense. And what the middle needs to do is reengage. We need to kind of take back our democracy and take back our narratives and take back our stories and reengage in ways that are more constructive and tolerant, you know, that are critical to a functioning democracy.
Peter Coleman is the author of the new book, The Way Out: How to Overcome Toxic Polarization. He's a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University. Columbia published the book as well. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Again, the name of the book, The Way Out: How to Overcome Toxic Polarization, by Peter Coleman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.